Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee and former Vice President Joe Biden has an 8.7% lead over incumbent President Donald Trump in a composite of national polls taken over the past 2 weeks. More significantly, Biden leads in key battleground states needed to win the 2020 presidential election, like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Florida. However, polls in 2016 had Trump losing to Democrat Hillary Clinton. The president and his supporters are counting on polls being wrong again. So how accurate are the polls? What can we learn from them today? And what's different in 2020 about them? Joining us today is Burwood Yost, director of the Floyd Institute for Public Policy Center for Opinion Research at Franklin and Marshall College. Burwood Yost, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment about polls, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk, WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Burwood, I had to run this by you before we get into some of the questions about what's different than 2016. The Gallup poll that was released earlier this week showed 91% of Republicans approving of the job President Trump is doing, while only 2% of Democrats approved. Never in the history of this poll that was started in the 1930s has there been a disparity that large. As a pollster, what does that say to you?
Well, good morning, Scott. It's great to be on your show. I've missed talking to you over the past few months. I think that what we're seeing in the Gallup poll ratings just reinforces the imperative of partisanship when we're talking about anything that is remotely political. I think one of the most significant changes that we've seen over the past 20 years nationally and in Pennsylvania is sort of the realignment of partisanship by political ideology. So, for instance, in Pennsylvania back in the year 2000, only about half of Republicans considered themselves conservative. Now it's closer to 75% or 80%. And the same is true on the other side with Democrats, far more identifying as liberals. So, we've seen the parties reorganize themselves in ways that are much more strongly ideological than they once were. And I think that's why you see these differences by party, because people have, taken on their political identity as part of their, their social identities and political identities have aligned, I guess is the simplest way to put it. So in some ways that makes polling easier, right? Because you have a category that's highly predictive that you can use to good effect.
As a pollster and someone who has, this is your career, long career, have you ever seen a poll with that big of a disparity?
No. I mean, but this has been a long time coming, right? We've slowly been sorting ourselves into these diverse silos over time. And so I think it was probably inevitable that we would eventually get here. There's a lot going on under there. As I said, you've got all these ideological attachments and resorting going on within the parties that have a whole bunch of other things associated with them, right? So So you also have political leadership that is trying to stoke these divisions as well. So, this is a continuation of a trend that has been emerging over two decades or more.
We're going to be talking about what we can learn from polls that are 4 months before an election. But if I was to just look at that Gallup poll, it would seem to be as simple as whichever party gets the most voters to the polls on election day, that their party's nominee is the winner.
Well, I think that's always the case, right?
Well, I know, but I mean, is it that simple?
It is simple. So more complicated than that, because if we're really looking at understanding what we need to understand about the coming election, and what's different about 2016, the first big difference is that you have an incumbent president on the ballot, right? That makes things very different. And that means that the horse race is also a product of these job approval ratings, right? And so if you are an incumbent candidate whose job approval is in the 30s, given that elections that include incumbents are typically about that incumbent's performance, Scott, you're in a tough spot, right? You know, the other thing that this doesn't make clear is that you do have independents in these polls. Now, it's, you know, maybe 10 or 12% of the public who are truly independent, depending. But among that group, which is the most important group, probably, given the polarization we see, you can see that the president's job approval rating is only at a third favorable. And that's the big issue for the president. It's not just that, you know, we've got these partisan camps and you've got to get out your base. That's absolutely true. But what about these independent voters, which will make up some part of the electorate, and they are also running away from the president? And that's, I think, that's the biggest concern I would have if I were part of his political team.
I guess my point was, when I asked that question about, you know, is this as simple as which party gets their voters out, is that because the disparity is so big and the two parties are so loyal to their nominees, you know, in other years, you would have crossover. This poll,
right.
If you just go by this poll, there's no crossover. I mean, you're
right.
Talking very little crossover. So it would come down to those independent voters.
Well, it does, but you also, I mean, I think when we looked at the data in 2016 and 2018, you still have about 10% of voters who you know, choose differently, say, between a Senate and a gubernatorial candidate or the presidential candidate and a Senate candidate. So there's still, I mean, swing voting isn't what it used to be. It's probably a third of what it once was, if you're looking at federal level elections, but still, you do have the occasional person who does that. But I think your broader point is it lost, right? I mean, and this is the foundation, I think, of the Trump campaign strategy. It is to make sure your base is so energized that its turnout overwhelms the opposition. So, you know, if you have a base strategy, you're betting on, you know, those divisions being to your advantage.
Now, this Gallup poll that we've been talking about, this was a national poll. What do national polls tell us?
Well, I guess if there's such a thing as the national mood, that's probably what they're telling us, Scott. But when we're talking about electoral politics, as you know, the national polls don't really matter much. What matters in our system, given the Electoral College, is the state-by-state accumulation of electoral votes. And so that's really where we need to focus our attention when we're thinking about, you know, issues related to the upcoming election.
So when we're talking, in my introduction, I mentioned that more significantly, right now, Joe Biden has a lead over the president in states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Florida, states that have a large amount of electoral voters. You know, that's what's more important when we're taking a look at these polls, correct?
Yes, it is. There's no doubt about it. I mean, and in fact, if we look back to 2016, right? I mean, a premise of your show today is what have we learned from 2016 or what's changed? You know, I think if we look back to 2016, there's a couple of things that we need to first rethink, right? First of all, the national polling was quite accurate. You know, I think it showed they missed by an average about 2%, right? If you think about what happened in 2016, you know, I think the error towards Hillary Clinton was about 1 point or so, right? So, you know, so the national polls were right on, given the limitations of polling. Where we had problems a bit were in some of the state polls. But there's a reason for that, too, which we can talk about. But basically, they overestimated Senator Clinton's share by about 3 points in the state polls, which made a difference, right? That if Pennsylvania, if you thought she had a three-point lead and the overestimate was about 3 points, you know, that is basically a tie, and that's where it ended up.
Yeah, Donald Trump won by like 44,000 votes in
right.
Pennsylvania.
And there's no, and it's important to understand, there is no poll done that is precise enough to predict with any certainty that kind of advantage, right? Our samples just aren't big enough to do that. We know that every survey, because it uses a sample to represent a broader population, it's going to have variability associated with that sampling process. So there's hopefully one thing that we've learned in the way that we report about polls is that polls are not a precision instrument. You know, they're a blunt tool, and there's a whole lot of other things that we need to look at when we're assessing a poll besides just that comparison of how one candidate compares to another. There's other things in there that matter, too.
And we'll talk about those. But I have an email here from listener Kid who says, there's always been the questions of, are polls put out there to inform, or are they put out there, let me get this, I just, you know, when you're doing this at home, Burwood, you know, I hit something on my computer and left my screen here. It says, are the polls put out there to inform, or are they put out there to affect perceptions? Social media is now a vehicle to supercharge opinions. A basic question, it seems to me, is who's paying for a particular poll? Can you trust the polls? There are a lot of questions there, but how do you answer some of those things?
Well, I think the listener is exactly right. I mean, who is publishing the poll, and what's the purpose of that polling? I mean, there are a lot of media organizations that do polling because they're just trying to understand the dynamics of the race. But, you know, there are plenty of other groups that are also trying to do polling to sort of make a statement, right? So I think you should always assess who is sponsoring the poll and to what purpose when you're judging whether or not you should trust it.
Your poll in particular, I mean, and a lot of polls are tied to colleges, universities, or to media organizations. When there, and it's been, you know, fostered by the president, and he's talked about fake news, there's such a lack of trust by many people, especially conservatives, on the media. Does that equate to a lack of trust in the polls if they're sponsoring a poll?
That's a complicated question.
I know
it is.
I know.
You know, I mean, of course, the more that you look, this goes back to your first question about partisanship and polarization, right? If a party leader expresses some perspective, people are likely to use that as a filter by which they judge. And so, yeah, I think it could lead to mistrust. But again, I mean, what matters is, or what really matters is how well we're able to sample and get those people, all people, to participate in the poll so that we have representative samples. I mean, that's the ultimate goal of all of us doing polling, is to try to create a sample that looks like, the registered voters in the state, or ultimately the likely voters in the state.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News. And all things regional, I'm Scott Lamar. Election coverage on WITF is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lear, LLP. During this portion of the program, our guest is Burwood Yost, director of the Floyd Institute for Public Policy Center for Opinion Research at Franklin and Marshall College. We're talking about polling and polls. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So have there been changes over the last 4 years since 2016, Burwood? And if so, what are they?
Well, I think, you know, there's been a constant reassessment, and there always has been, I should say, after every election. Pollsters always look at their methods and are trying to refine them and improve them. And part of that's driven by changes in the way we can sample people. Part of that's driven in the way that we reach people. So change and adaptation is constant in the polling industry because that's what we have to do. We have to constantly adapt and improve our methods. I think, you know, there's been the piece that has been strongest and generated the most discussion around pollsters has to do with the composition of our samples and how we make sure we adjust for certain types of voters that may have been underrepresented. In 2016, I think there's a common sentiment that white working class voters may have been underrepresented in some of these polls, and so that we should do some adjustments to make sure that that representation exists within our polling. So that's probably the biggest methodological change, besides sort of tweaks here and there. It's to make sure that we've got more representative samples. And so we've all worked on that to do a better job of figuring out what are the key demographic groups that are going to exist within the population, and do we have those groups represented in our survey? That's the first thing. But I think the other thing, Scott, is how we report about the polls. I think one of the major problems in 2016 wasn't the polling itself. As I said, the national polls were as accurate as they've ever been. The state polls were about as accurate as they usually are, right? So the poll performance was not that unusual in 2016. I think the problem we had in 2016 was the way the media portrayed and reported on the polls. There were a whole lot of poll aggregation sites and poll handicappers that built these statistical models that said the chances of Trump winning were almost 0%, right? And that's what got reported, that these statistical modeling experts really underestimated the uncertainty that was in the election. Because if you looked at the polls and what they were saying, there was a lot in there that was accurate, right? We know leading up to the election that both of the major party candidates were historically unpopular. Like 16% of voters in Pennsylvania had an unfavorable opinion of both candidates. That was only 3%, for example, in 2012. The polls also showed there were a lot of undecided and third-party voters, right? They totaled nearly 14 points in the surveys that we were doing through the last month of the election, right? That number was only 5% in 2012. I think we also saw in those polls a strong desire for change. We also saw in the polling that the race was tightening. So if you looked at many of the different indicators that polls were able to produce, besides just the horse race, you could see that there were interesting things happening. But because the focus so much is on this gap between the candidates, maybe we missed that. And I think it's important, and I hope we've all learned as we go forward, that one, we remember that polls are not precision instruments, they're approximations. That two, there's always variability associated with polling. And three, that there's lots of information that polls can tell us beyond just the horse race. If we keep those things in mind, we'll probably all be better suited to understand and interpret findings that these polls produce.
Does the public understand, and maybe even the media, understand the purpose of a poll? I mean, one of the things that has been drilled into me as a journalist is that polls are not predictions. The four right. months out, when we're giving these numbers, these are not predictions of who is going to win the election. It is a snapshot right. at this moment. Does the right. public understand that? Does the media understand that?
I don't know, Scott. I haven't asked that question. I guess maybe I should ask that question sometime on one of our polls. But, you know, I think that's important to keep in mind that, you know, that polls are a snapshot, and there should be multiple things that we're looking at when we assess any poll. It should never just boil down to the difference between the two candidates, because that's probably the least important number that comes out of the polls that we do. As we do this work, first of all, we have not released a head-to-head matchup between Trump and Biden yet, because we didn't think it was appropriate to start polling on the horse race question so early, because that's all anyone pays attention to. So we've been looking at things like how people feel about their economic circumstances, how people feel about the direction of the state and the country, how people view the performance of President Trump in office, how they feel favorability towards different candidates, what are the main issues they think about. So, you know, we've tried to avoid to this point. Now, we'll probably start in July doing the head-to-head matchup, but, you know, we think it's sort of distracting to just focus on the horse race. So that's one change that we've made, that we're trying to limit the number of times that we report on the head-to-head matchup.
Well, then, that's a big question, because every day there seems to be a new poll somewhere across the country. What do polls 4 months away from the election tell us?
Well, it depends what you're looking at, right? If you're looking at the president's job approval, that tells you something very clearly, that there's pretty widespread dissatisfaction with the performance of the president at the current time. And so I think that's a valid assessment, right? But whether Biden is leading by 8 or 9 or 4 or 5 or whatever it is, that's less important. So I really think it depends what you're looking at. I think in this circumstance, what's different than, as I said earlier, about 2020 than 2016, is you've got an incumbent president, and that this election will be a judgment about that president's performance. And so looking at something like the job performance ratings across time is a useful thing to do, because it gives you a sense of how well-positioned that president is for re-election.
Let's take a couple phone calls. Jeff is in Hanover. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, what have polls shown so far about the effect of the Bernie Sanders supporters on Biden's chances, and the millennials, which constitutes now the largest voting group in the country, I believe. Are they going to ruin it for Biden and give us 4 more years for Trump? Thank you.
Okay. I'm sure you study other polls, Burwood. What have you learned, if anything, about the Biden supporters, or excuse me, the Sanders supporters and their support for Biden?
Yeah, I think there's been some evidence that the Sanders supporters and the progressives in general are starting to move and be supportive of Biden. We don't see kind of the third-party numbers that we've seen, that we saw in 2016. And make no mistake about it, that third-party vote in 2016 made a big difference in Trump's success, President Trump's success in this state. So I think that's an important question, and it's something that we're going to keep an eye on. But at this point, I don't think it's a problem. And the caller also asked about millennials. Look, young people are overwhelmingly supportive of the Biden candidacy. But the problem with younger voters has always been their turnout rates. And so I in terms of their support for Biden, you know, it seems to be there. If that translates into turnout in on election day, that's just going to be a fundamental question. Will that happen? You know, I think the flip side of that is we've seen some erosion in some of these polls of, you know, the constituency that elected President Trump in this state. He's had some slippage among female voters, among older voters, among even white working class voters in some of these polls. And so those things all, you know, they're all going to matter. And again, this all comes down to a judgment about the president's performance. And how these different groups that supported him in 2016 either stick with him or decide not to vote or to vote for another candidate.
And, you know, it's almost a cliche, but the reason it becomes a cliche is that when an incumbent is involved, that an election is a referendum on the incumbent. Is that true?
Yeah, I think I might. Earlier myself, right? I mean, that's I think it's that's part of what's a bit surprising about the president's current strategy is he seems to continue to want to run a bit as an outsider, and I think that's hard to do when you've been in charge for 3.5 years. So we'll see if that's successful. But I don't in my experience that's typically the case, that the races that involve incumbents are typically about those incumbents, unless there's some broader kind of wave. So if you're talking about a congressional race, where there may be national trends that affect the local races, you know, that's when incumbency may be less important. And we've seen a decline in the importance of incumbency because of that in some kinds of races. But when you're talking about a governor, when you're talking about a president, I don't think there's any question that that's really the fundamental thing that voters are thinking about, is how did this executive do his or her job.
Let's take a phone call from Brian in Lancaster. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. Thank you for taking my call. So I was actually interested to hear about talking about polls as predictive tools and how the media uses polls to analyze election cycles. One of the things I was wondering about, anecdotally, I've heard people speak about how polling results can potentially impact voter turnout, where if you maybe see a candidate who is trailing or has a significant lead, that might in the future impact voter turnout for that candidate. Maybe not as many people show up. Is that something that has been demonstrated to be true?
So it's a great question, and it's a question that I'm frequently asked. Do polls influence behaviors, or do polls change the way people do things? And the answer is we haven't been able to find much evidence that that's the case. But I think that's always a driving concern. I think in the Biden camp and among Democrats right now, you know, they'll keep reminding you that the polling misled us in 2016, so we should ignore the polls and get out and vote, because they feel like they don't want to do anything to suppress their turnout. So I think theoretically, you know, if you suspect that one candidate has a large lead and is going to win, and maybe you're more likely to stay home. But we just don't have any good studies that are able to demonstrate that sort of effect of polling itself. Now, there is some evidence from many years ago that the reporting of actual election outcomes before the polls closed could have had some effect. But actual, you know, using poll numbers, you know, probably not. You know, we often talk about bandwagon effects, where people rally to the leader, but then you also have people have proposed underdog effects, where people, you know, find the underdog more appealing. So there's all these kind of conflicting theories, none of which really have a lot of strong empirical support.
Burwood, you talked earlier about polls having to adapt your sample size, your demographics, that kind of thing. one of the things that the president has been saying when these polls, results of these polls have been reported showing Biden with a lead in some of the key states, is that Republican voters are being underrepresented. Have you seen that, any evidence of that throughout the country with any of the polls that you've seen?
So I haven't at this point. And in fact, this mirrors the common complaint. If you remember 2012, there was this whole movement to unskew the polls. Do you remember that, Scott, where they were talking about how underrepresented Republicans were and that you needed to rebalance this stuff? And the polls were right in 2012, as they were largely right in 2018 and 2016 and 2014. I mean, there's a long track record of success, and I think it gets around these expectations. So I don't think they're underrepresented because of all the attention pollsters are paying to make sure they get representative samples. Is it possible that they may be in any given poll? Sure. But I thought where you might go were these what we call shy Trump voters, right? People who are going to vote for Trump who don't tell a pollster that. And, you know, we can't find much strong evidence for that. So we do our polls in a mixed, what we call a mixed mode approach, where the people can answer on the phone or they can answer online, whatever fits their circumstance best. And if there were a shy Trump effect, you would think that the distribution of support for the president in the online polls should be different for when people are talking to an interviewer, right? But we didn't see any differences whether someone talked to an interviewer or whether someone did a poll online in their support for the president. So it's, at least in 2016, we didn't see strong evidence for the shy Trump voter. Now, what is more likely, particularly in 2016, was that maybe those people were unwilling to participate in polls, which gets back to this whole notion of underrepresentation of certain groups and the work that's been done since then to make sure we understand and round out our samples appropriately.
You know, we've talked about this many times, but with today's technology, I mean, you've had to change how you actually poll because so many people rely on their mobile phones or cell phones. With caller ID for even the landlines, sometimes people see survey on the caller ID and don't pick it up. So how do you compensate for that, Burwood?
Well, polling's gotten harder to do, and it's more expensive. But we've had to do things differently. For instance, in the past, for many years, you could just call a number and randomly pick people and talk to them. But since people use caller ID now and since they aren't likely to pick up their phone, we now mail a postcard to everyone in our samples and say, hey, guess what? We're doing this legitimate survey. We hope you participate. Here's how you can participate if we've sampled you. If you want to do the survey online, or you can call us, or you can wait, and we'll call you. So we've had to do a lot more in terms of pre-notification to let people know we're calling them. We've also done things behind the scenes where we've actually registered our phones as we went through a process where we're a trusted calling organization so that we're not labeled as spam or fraud callers by the telephone service providers. So there are a number of steps that we've taken both methodologically and technologically to try to make sure people that we sample, that we can get access to them.
Burwood, so much to talk about. Always enjoy having a conversation with you. Hopefully our listeners learned a lot, and when they hear the results of the next poll, they'll have a good understanding of what they're looking at. Burwood Yost is the director of Floyd Institute for Public Policy Center for Opinion Research at Franklin and Marshall College. Burwood, thanks for being with us today.
You bet, Scott. Thanks for having me. I look forward to talking to you again.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, the travel industry was one of the fastest growing sectors of the global economy. No longer is COVID-19 applied the emergency brakes to any near-term growth of tourism. However, alcohol and cigarette sales in the U.S. are on the rise, as are outdoor recreation products like RVs and bicycles. What these anecdotes show is that some industries have been hit hard by the pandemic, while others have actually been more successful. Joining us to talk about, I hate to put it this way, but winners and losers, those who have fared well, those who haven't fared so well, and the markets, Ben Levison, managing editor for Markets at Barron's. It's an investing publication of the Dow Jones and Company, and I'm sure you've seen it many times on the newsstand and online. Mr. Levison, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Before we get into who have fared well, the businesses that haven't fared as well, let's take a step back. What was happening in the financial markets at the beginning of 2020?
Well, at the beginning of the year, the markets were really optimistic. They were optimistic about the economy, and that meant that they were optimistic about stocks. And so we had this great rally to start off the year. The Federal Reserve, the central bank here in the United States, had been pumping money into the economy since the middle of 2019, and that was really starting to take effect. And so things looked great. Unemployment was low. And the economy looked to be firing on all cylinders, and then COVID hit. And that really just changed the trajectory of everything very, very quickly.
Now, there was a big sell-off, though, at the end of January. Did that have anything to do with a potential pandemic event?
Yeah, there was definitely that had that was the initial drop because of COVID. You'd had this big rally, so people were, we'd like to say that stocks were overextended and that people were maybe a bit over their skis is kind of the jargon that gets used on Wall Street. But the people have been really optimistic. They bought a lot of stuff. And then the headlines start coming out of China, and they think, well, maybe I need to dial things back. And so they sold. The markets fell. But then they said, you know what, maybe not. And then they start buying again. But then we started seeing the disease get over to the United States, and it became very clear very quickly that this was going to be a huge problem here in the United States, not just abroad.
And let's take kind of a step backwards.
Sure.
Is the stock market, the markets, are they a good barometer or even predictor of the health of the economy?
No, not really. They don't reflect what our economy looks like for the most part. They're still just such a huge component of the markets are made up of companies like Apple and Microsoft. Those are the two biggest. But you take the five biggest tech stocks, there's something like 25% of the market. And so the market can go up even when the economy, the regular folks out there, the economy might not be doing so great, but a company like Apple can do fantastic. So the market really isn't a great barometer for the economy all the time.
You know, something you just said probably is something that many people don't realize. The five biggest tech stocks are worth 25% of the market. That's incredible.
It really is amazing. They just dominate everything, and there's good reasons for it. I mean, we all use their products. The other part of it is, and you can see this in how the market, how the coronavirus has affected the economy in our daily lives, is that if you have a fixed payment that you have to make, let's say you're a restaurant owner and you have to make a rent payment every month, you have to make that payment regardless of whether you have customers coming in or not, though there has been some changes around that because of the virus. But for a lot of these companies, they don't have those kind of fixed costs that that other companies do. And so they can keep bringing in, and they're selling products that people do want. So they kind of have it as a win-win on both sides. They're still getting their sales coming in, but they don't have the fixed costs that would pull things down. And so they deserve that, but they're just an immense part of the market at this point.
Hmm. Well, and let's talk about that, because when we're talking about industries that have done well and those that haven't done as well, tech stocks or tech businesses, tech industries, that's an industry that has maintained its success and actually increased its success. Isn't that accurate?
That is correct. We'd like to talk about the NASDAQ composite index as a reflection of the tech stocks, unlike the S&P 500, which is very broad. So it'll have tech, it'll have utilities, it'll have all kinds of companies in there. The NASDAQ has a lot of tech, and it has a lot of biotech, and so that makes it look very differently. That index is actually up on the year. It's up 17%, which is just amazing when you think about it, and that's because of tech stocks. It's the things that we might never have heard of before this started, things like Zoom, which now so many people use to talk to each other, things like Slack, which companies are putting in place to allow their workers to talk to each other while they're sitting at their computers so they can text with each other very quickly. All these stay-at-home things did so well. All these companies like Netflix that can provide movies while you're at home, I mean, everybody knows that, are doing so well when you have a company like AMC, which operates the theaters. And the discussion in the marketplace right now is whether or not it's going to have to file for bankruptcy. So tech just doesn't have these real-world problems that so many other companies do, and it's reflected in how well the sector has done this year.
I know, and this may be a bit of a narrow question, but you know, we've heard stories, anecdotal anyway, over the past few weeks that many businesses, many employers have found that their workers are doing quite well at working from home, and that it may be permanent. So I would think that bodes well for, you know, there are a lot of other reasons you just explained, but that bodes even better for these tech companies.
That's right. They will be used more and more because we're seeing how easy it is to use them. We can do conference calls without having to be in the same room with each other. We can, I mean, we see it in my newsroom where we're just talking to each other by text, and we're able to put out a print magazine without being in the same newsroom together, which I didn't think could happen when this all started. It's amazing. But that's also going to be bad news for real estate. You know, if you don't need to have everybody in the same place, you don't need to have all that office space. And so what happens to office buildings? You know, there are some changes that will happen there. People are going to have to sit further apart. So the one people that do go into work will need more space. So it's not as clear-cut as it sometimes seems, but you do have some very clear people that are benefiting from this and some that are going to really experience some very drastic change.
Well, we talked about industries that have done well, and now I want to talk about some that haven't done so well. Which industries felt the negative impact first?
At first, it's been retail. Retail is just for two reasons. The first is that everything was shut, so nobody could go out and shop. And, you know, that's kind of the obvious side of it. But also because of the recession that happened with this, people didn't want to spend money. So that's a second hit to it. So even if they could spend, they weren't spending as much. And so you saw all retailers, anything except for the companies selling stuff that people needed. So you had Target was fine, Walmart was fine, Amazon was fine. They were all essential services. They were open. But everybody else was having a really hard time, either because they were shut or because people didn't want to buy stuff. That's changed a bit along the way because now we know that we're not just going to be shut in all the time. And the big fiscal stimulus package that the government put into place, so these checks that got sent out to everyone and the extra unemployment benefits, have meant people are actually saving a lot but spending a little more too, and they're making their houses nicer. They're stuck in their houses, so they're shopping at places like Lowe's and Home Depot, Wayfair. They're doing stuff to make their living space more comfortable. And so that's been good. And then people went on and realized that, you know, I can go out, but maybe just not be with other people. So they're buying things like coolers from Yeti, which make these extremely expensive coolers. But somehow those are still getting bought because people want to go out and they want to just be out in the world. And so they're buying those things. But for the other retailers, and we saw today, Brooks Brothers, you know, they make nice suits that you wear to go to work every day. But if you're not going to work, you don't need a suit. And so Brooks Brothers has filed for bankruptcy. And so a lot of the apparel retailers are still having a very tough time. because no one needs that stuff. We're just wearing the clothes that we have around the house. We could put on a shirt and do the meetings that we need to, and we just don't need to worry about having that that perfect looking suit to go to a meeting.
You know, the travel industry, as I mentioned in the introduction, is one that has been hit hard. If anything, you know, there's a lot that we can learn from this, but I think that many people can look at this and say, realize how important tourism and travel is to our economy, and especially on a state basis or a local basis where there are destinations. But travel has been hit hard. I mean, especially airlines, I mean, or the cruise lines. I mean, that is an industry that, again, people should appreciate that how much of a part of our economy that is.
Yeah, and it's an enormous part of the economy. You look at airlines and just the amount of people that they employ, both in just, you know, getting people checked in, maintaining the planes, and then even how that extends there, where you have big industrial companies that are making parts to put into those planes. I mean, it's just a huge portion of the economy, and they're having a tough time. And it's and even when it was starting to look better, but this second wave of coronavirus that has popped up has really got people pulling back from buying tickets again. And that just spreads through everything. It means that a company like Boeing, which is making the planes, isn't going to be making as much planes. And Boeing is a huge employer. And it really is a problem, both for the tourism jobs on the ground, for the companies that make planes. It just spreads everywhere. And it even shows up in a company like Disney. And Disney was one where it looked like it had the perfect setup with its parks and its movies that were going into the theaters. And then it has the streaming, and it has had the sports channels. And you take their parks out of it, though, and it's a huge problem for them, not to mention the parts about movies and sports. But the parks were such a great source of cash. And all of a sudden, it becomes a cash suck. And you have to maintain the parks, but nobody can go there. And so it just spreads through everything. And every state has their own kind of Disney World thing that you know, attracts people. And it just it does spread into everything in the economy.
We are about 6 months into this new normal, and some of the dust has settled. But as you mentioned, I don't know whether it's a second wave or just the end of the first wave, or we're still in the first wave or what. But what has surprised you the most?
Part of it is how quickly the government responded to what was happening. It seemed the last time we had a major recession with the financial crisis, it took a while for both parties to agree that something needed to be done. In this case, it was very obvious, I think, that the economy was going to shut down, and it wasn't going to be anybody's fault that things were going to get hard, that they were going to lose their jobs. And so the government acted very fast. And so what could have been just a truly horrible depression, even, I think that was headed off very quickly. And I was surprised by that. I was very relieved by that as well. I think the economy is doing much better than it would have otherwise. And what's been interesting is watching how people have gone from a very narrow mindset of, okay, I just need to make sure that I have enough toilet paper, I need to have enough cans of soup in my house, and all those things, to trying to figure out what they're comfortable with and how to get those things into their lives. So people buying Winnebagos so they can still travel but not have to stay in hotels, which have been hit very hard, or fly, and things like that. That's been very interesting to me, is just to see how people decide what's important, what isn't, what's essential to them, not in terms of what do they need on a day-to-day basis just to live, but what kind of experiences are essential to them. And that's been just fascinating to watch, both economically in terms of what's been coming back. Where I live, we're seeing restaurants now that have put seats out on the sidewalk and are serving people out there, and some of them are very full. People clearly want to do those things. And we're seeing in the stock market, too, where it went from being very narrow in terms of who might win and who might lose to having some very differentiated views about the winners and losers, where you still have the tech as the big winners, and you still have things like department stores like Macy's, which are big, which are really being priced as if they are going to have a tough time coming back. But you have a lot of things in the middle, too, even things like Darden Restaurants, which is trying to navigate this by having more takeout food and things like that.
Ben Levinson is managing editor for Markets at Barron's. Learned a lot today, Mr. Levinson. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to talk about daycare, childcare during the pandemic also.